The Rishus of the Chashuv Rabbanim, I ask you all to pardon my voice, but I'm somewhat vocally impaired. That's my voice. Poskim Bichvod Achsanya, Young Israel of Woodmere, is a rather proud shul on the American horizon. It has a very Chashuv Rabbanus. I think all of us from outside are envious of a staff that includes Rabbi Billet, for whom an MS has no price. Rabbi Schechter, a rising ultra Talmud Chacham, who the whole Torah world is proud of. Rabbi Glatt, who brings the disciplines of Chachma and Torah to an intersection. And Rabbi Axelrod, who I need to tell you, I told him earlier, it was his grandfather that made everything I have for me. If there was Avas Yisrael, and if there was a Cheshek to learn Torah, and if there was Chibas Tzion, and an interest in the sciences, it came from Rabbi Axelrod's grandfather, Dr. Axelrod, Olav Shalom, who was my and my brother's Olav Beis Rebbe. You know, speaking to doctors is sometimes intimidating. The halachic discourse is a different one. It's a practical one. It's a dynamic one. It's one that constantly has new horizons. For example, in the lab that I'm part of in Jerusalem, the question is, when does life begin? Is it fertilization? Is it implantation? Probably not fertilization, because 80% of the fertilized eggs fail. Is it 40 days of gestation? Is it the first trimester? Is it two trimesters? Is it when a majority of the head is out? Or is it when you graduate from medical school that you first become a mensch? This week's parsha establishes all the physicians with a divine mandate. Verapo, Yerape, Kainidla Rishus L'Rofim L'Rapos. It gives you a divine mandate for a very, very noble profession. Fulfilling Redubaretz V'Kivshua, coming down into this world and doing God's work. God himself delegates to the physician that role. Parshas Mishpatim is a parsha that I guess sets up Beis Din. It's on which we built all of Choshen Mishpat. Dayanim and Batei Din need to be Bekiyim in Mishpatim. Mishpatim is preceded, however, at the very end of Yisro, by the Halacha v'Mizbeach. V'Mizbach Avonim Taseli Lo Sivnez and Gozes. If you could build a Mizbeach out of stones, which, by the way, was incumbent on us, you shouldn't hew them. You shouldn't cut them with a steel blade. Because you put your sword on them and you made them secular, you made them chol. The truth be told, the Beis Mikdash was built with loads of hewing and loads of cutting. Shlomo HaMelech used the shamir, that insect, to cut stone. That was his chumrah. That was the chumrah of Shlomo HaMelech. Had he done it with a metal cutting sword, it would have been okay. I want to suggest that what the Torah is telling us is that we mustn't take the stones found in nature and hew them, cut them into squares, express the arts and the sciences and architecture that you can build, balance, transfer stresses. It's the hewing of a stone that is our technology, improving on the raw materials of nature to build. And it's as if the Torah tells us you can bring technology and science and art every place in the Beis Mikdash. But the Makom Avoda itself, the Mizbeach, mustn't be tainted by the advances of technology and the sciences. How do you really know where that begins and where that ends? Where does technology apply, and from where must it be distanced? Is our davening to be tolerant of changes in technology. Is the mitzvah verapo yirape to be involved in the advances of technology? And that becomes a very big problem, to define that very, very thin red line, the borders of what's halachically correct and what's incorrect. When does a physician interfere with natural processes, and when does he step back humbly and allow providence to take its course? And for that, we need gedolim. We need gedolim who are unusually large talmidei chachamim, who have a huge breadth of halacha, of our poskim, of course of Shas Shulchan Aruch, who are able to define for us as Haderech Asher Yelchu Bah, who are able to do that, who are able to appreciate the sciences and understand the nuances where they intersect with Allah. I have the privilege of an affiliation with Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Yerushalayim. I remember so well when the previous poskim had to be replaced. One was nifter and one became unwell. And there was a lot of pressure. You can't imagine the pressure. In fact, the director general once was in a room with 10, 12 hoodlum chassidim who were ready to beat the guy up if he didn't take a posek from the Eda. It was a unanimous, unchallenged call when the name of Usha Weiss came up. It was a man who had all the credentials obvious. It was a man who was a vast Talmud Chacham, unchallenged, acceptable to the broad spectrum of the halachic Jew internationally, and a man who had an appreciation and understanding of the sciences, probably as much as most physicians. It was a giant step forward. And I'll tell you what the big thing was for me personally, and I suspect for all of us here who are here to hear the Torah of Rav Weiss. It was a breath of fresh air that Yiddishkeit wasn't fossilized. Halacha wasn't inanimate. Everything was reanimated, was put together again in a most labedic fashion. Torah was again alive and well in Yerushalayim. And I have to tell you, in Shaarei Tzedek, there has never been a moment of conflict of concern. Rotzei l'rovechov on top of it. So it's with a sense of trepidation and humility, but also a sense of pride, that I can stand here and introduce Rav Usha Weiss Shlita, one of Gedolei Yisrael, and one of the very important dynamic Gedolei Yisrael of our generation. Rav Weiss.
Thank you all for turning up this morning, and I am very happy to be back again. Thank you for the rabbanim of this wonderful kehillah, my dear Talmud and friend Rav Shai Shechter, Rav Glatt, Rav Axelrod, and thank you, my dear friend Rabbi Fuld, for your warm and somewhat exaggerated introduction. It is chus and a privilege to serve Klal Yisrael. I always teach my Talmidim, life is a mission, and each and every one of us is here to do his duty. And Yehi Rotzen, we should be able to fulfill, to understand what our duty is, and to try to fulfill that duty in the light that Kodesh Baruch Hu gave us to understand that duty. So yes, I'm proud to be affiliated with Shaarei Tzedek, as I am with many other endeavors in halacha, in medicine, in teaching Torah, in disseminating Torah, and just trying to fulfill my duty. So today's conference, I understand, will be two different parts, and the first shiur, or the first session, will be dedicated to mental health issues from the halachic perspective. We have a lot to do and a lot to do better dealing with mental health issues in our communities from the social point of view and not only from the pure medical perspective, but this session by its very nature will be dedicated more to the halachic aspect of mental health problems. How do we define pikuach nefesh? And would mental illness be defined as pikuach nefesh? So most of these shilas come up not regarding Hilchos Shabbos, more regarding Dinei Yom Kippur. So people that have mental illness, would they be entitled, should they take their medicine on Yom Kippur? And if they need to eat or drink with their medicine, would they be entitled to do so? Do we have clear definitions regarding mental health and questions of pikuach nefesh? So the first source, first and foremost, probably would be the Mishnah. The Mishnah in Shabbos, Chof Tes Omid Beis. HaMechabet Aner Mepnei Listim Ganovim Ruach Ra Hareze Poto. How do we define Ruach Ra? Literally translated, bad spirit. So what is a bad spirit? Rashi, defining Ruach Ra, is a person that is possessed by a bad spirit. And when it's dark, Kishuhu Yoshev Bechoshech Noachlo, he feels more comfortable when it's dark, in a dark environment. And therefore, it is permissible to put out the light, to extinguish the candle, to make him more comfortable. Obviously, that would be defined as pikuach nefesh. Because the Gemara doesn't go into the discussion whether kibbi would be malach hashen sicha l'gufa, yes or no, which is a machlokes in Tanua. So Rashi explains, ruach ra, a person that is possessed by a bad spirit and he feels more at ease and at comfort when he's sitting in the dark. The Rambam in Perasha Mishnah defines ruach ra in Arabic, melancholia, which we could only guess that probably it has something to do with melancholy, which is a form of depression. And the Rambam writes that this illness is matsui etzel balei hamora, which we call in our ancient language mora shchoiro. So obviously the Rambam's definition of ruach ra would be some form of depression. Roughly speaking, in very broad categories, we know that mental illness is roughly broken down to two different categories, psychosis and neurosis. So I think that Rambam's description fit into neurosis, which either would be euphoria or depression, ups and downs like bipolar illness, and Rashi's description would fit into psychosis. People suffering from psychotic illnesses sometimes feel possessed and they hear voices and they get messages no one else hears or gets. And sometimes they act in an extremely irrational way, being possessed by forces that they are not familiar with. And that fits into Rashi's description. When it's dark, he is in command of himself. He doesn't see those bad spirits that possess him. So the Mishnah and the Gemara make it very clear that a malocha and Shabbos would be permissible in a case of ruach ra, of a bad spirit. And it's not the only source in Shas in which we find a rough description of some type of mental illness which would be defined as pikuach nefesh. So in Tanis, in Masechet Tani, Daf Chav Beis, Reish Peches and Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Shabbos, we deal with when do we bring together people to daven on Shabbos? Either when a sakana looms on the community, or even on an individual if it is a clear pikuach nefesh. So one of the situations in which it is justified bringing people together to daven, to pray for tzorche yochid, for bakoshes, would be once again ruach ra. As we learn, Shulchan Aruch Chaim Simereish Peches, and the source is in Tanas Daf Chov Beis. And Rashi there goes another step forward. Why would this be considered pikuach nefesh? Shema yipol. He might fall or he might drown. So we could guess maybe he might develop suicidal tendencies. He might become suicidal. Or maybe he just wouldn't have the ability to care for himself and to distance himself from danger. So Rashi explains, why would the bad spirit be defined as a potential sakona and a pikuach nefesh situation? Tshuvas HaRashba, Tshuvot HaMiyuchasot, Simereish Peyalav. The Rashba deals with the question a person swore, he made a shavua, shelo yesachek im mois. What would that mean? Well, he swore that he's not going to gamble. Obviously, he's in some program for Rishon, and he made a shavua. And he fell into a depression. And he felt better when he did. Is he entitled to violate that shavua? And the Rashba paskens, yes. If he feels better, then that would override violating one's shavua, which is an issa d'oraisa. And the basis of the Rashba's ruling is the sugya of Ruach Ra and the sugya in Shabbos Kuf Chof Chesem at base dealing with Yesuve Daita. So in Tshuvas HaRashba, once again, we find an early and most important source dealing with what the Rashba defines as Tiruf Adas or Shigoin. On the other hand, there's a Sif in Shulchan Aruch, Shin Chof Ches, Sif Lamed Hei, regarding Misha Ochze Ruach Ra, and the Shulchan Aruch says, Ein Bo Sakona, and therefore, one cannot do a Malacha D'oraisa. So we must assume that there are different types of bad spirits, and different types of mental situations. We are totally unfamiliar with what early generations were aware of. While medicine wasn't very developed, definitely mental health was not very well developed and defined. But as we move down the generations, we find more tshuvas dealing with different types of apparent mental conditions. Shalas HaTshuvas Pri Haaretz, merely 200 years ago, Yoregei, Chelek Gimel, Simen Beis, deals with a person, Shenitrafo Olav Datoi, and there was a need to tie his hands and feet. So obviously, if he had to be tied down, he was a danger to himself or to others. And somebody suggested feeding him nevela, and that was considered a refua beduka. And the priots paskins, this is a potential sakona, and therefore we could feed him nevela, which is a clear isur diurais. Rav Moshe Nigris Moshe, Evan Ezra, Chelek Aleph Simen Samachai, deals with postpartum depression. And he once again says this would be considered a sakona and a pikuach nefesh situation. So even the Eges Moshe 50 years ago doesn't go into many details. And they all assumed from the times of the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Rashba, and the Achroinim up to the Eges Moshe, that the deterioration of one's mental health would be defined as pikuach nefesh in different areas, whether it's Silcha Shabbos or it's Macholois Asurois. As I mentioned a few moments ago, today we know far more than what they knew even 50 or 100 years ago. but we still don't know enough. And I think science and medicine has been far more successful in understanding physical illnesses than mental illnesses. We have a better appreciation and understanding how our bodies work than our understanding of how our minds work. So what does a Pisic do when he is presented with questions regarding mental health issues? So the safest thing a Pisic could do is just recommend the patient consult his physician, his doctor, his professional, that knows him and his unique situation better than anyone else. So many times dealing with questions of taking medicine on Yom Kippur, my ruling is very simple. Taking medicine would not be defined as an issur d'oraisa, not even an issur d'rabbanan. So if it's only medicine, they should all take their medication, whether it's psychosis or neurosis or whatever it is. If food or drinks are needed as well. So in psychotic situations, yes, a person could pose a direct danger to himself or to others. That is true regarding psychosis, because sometimes these people are, as described in the Rishonim, possessed, and they are detached from reality, and they could pose a real danger to themselves, to their families, and to others. And even in neurotic situations, when a person suffers from extreme anxiety or depression, he could be suicidal, he could be a danger to himself, to his immediate family, to others. So if their doctors feel that this is what they need, this is what they should do. When people have psychotic attacks, they might also be defined, but this I mentioned just briefly, the halachic description of a shaita. And in those moments, they might be potam and a mitzvah, or maybe even as oines, an oines rachmona patre. Because when the psychologically impaired feel that they need to eat or they need to drink, we do not have any chiyuv to stand in their way and prevent them from doing so. And that probably would be defined as an oines situation. How do we define pikuach nefesh? And this brings us to a broader dilemma. How do we define pikuach nefesh? And when would we say that a certain situation posing a danger to oneself or to others would halachically fit into the criteria of pikuach nefesh, not only permitting but necessitating chil Shabbos or the violation of any other issur d'oraisa? So many years ago, we find an amazing exchange of ideas and opinions between two of the greatest Gedolim, Reb Shlomo Zalman and the Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Waldenberg. Tzitz Eliezer, Chelek Tesemin, Yud Zayin, we find two conflicting opinions. Reb Shlomo Zalman felt that Pikuach Nefesh is defined by people, by the general impression and consent of people. A situation in which people feel is pikuach nefesh would, by halachic criteria, be defined as pikuach nefesh. Amo debar, the way most people feel. How then would we define pikuach nefesh? So Reb Shlomo Zalman argued that any situation in which people in the middle of the week would rush to the hospital for fear of losing a life, they should do the same on Shabbos. And that would be defined as pikuach nefesh. The Tzitz Eliezer argues, how could we let people decide what is pikuach nefesh? Only professionals, doctors, professionals in their field, only they are authorized to decide what is a pikuach nefesh situation. So the Tzitz Eliezer mentions that there's a gadol in Yerushalayim, and whenever his finger hurts, he calls the greatest professor in the city. So, for him, would that be defined as pikuach nefesh? And would we say that he is entitled to do so on Shabbos as well, because he is very nervous and extremely agitated by every minor ailment? So the Tzitz Eliezer argues, only professionals could decide. And I wonder, so what would be the criteria for the professionals to decide? So would we say percentage points? I make it very clear in many shiurim I give to my Talmidim in Yerushalayim. Nowhere do we find in Chazal or in the great Poskim, going back many ages, that they deal with percentage points. They couldn't deal with percentage points, because as long as you don't do statistics, how would you ever know? And statistical sciences weren't developed 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago. And that is why nowhere do we find in Chazal any mention of achuzim, of percentage points, whether it's 10% or 20% or 30%. How would they know if they didn't do statistics? What we find in Chazal and in all the major poskim are of ideas. Miut hamotzui. How do we define miut hamotzui? So the Rivash, the great disciple of Rabbeinu Nissim, going back 600 years, says that miut hamotzui is something that approaches 50%. It's still a miut, but it's a very common miut. So without doing statistics, you could know roughly what is very common. And everybody quotes the Mishkan Es Yaakov as saying 10%. The Mishkan Es Yaakov is a big marach, and he has an extremely lengthy discussion in Simei Yud Zayin. And at some stage in that tshuva, he writes 10%. But if you have the patience and the time to go through the entire tshuva, at the end of that tshuva, he retracts, and he doesn't say 10%. So miut hamotzui is something that is to be expected. It happens, not very common. But anything that isn't the norm, something that isn't a real surprise, would be defined as miut hamotzui. So how does one define pikuach nefesh, which would necessitate violating an issa d'oraisa to save life? We seem to have somewhat of a contradiction. A Yerledes is defined by halacha criteria as a cholei sheyesh b'sakana, and we are mechalel Shabbos to care for the needs of a woman in labor during the process of childbirth or right after childbirth. However, it is clear in Shabbos Kuf Chof Chasam et Beis and a Shulchan Aruch Simin Shin Lamed, when we care for a Yerledes, we need to do a shinui. And the Magen Mishnah explains why. Why is a shinui not required for any other cholei sheyesh b'sakana, only for a yoledes? So quoting the exact lashon of the Magen Mishnah says, because leida is a dovor tivi. It's something that's natural. It's not an illness, Baruch Hashem. The isho achas me'elaf eino meso machmas leida. And death, Baruch Hashem, is extremely uncommon. One of 1,000 doesn't lose her life by having a baby. And therefore, a shinui is recommended when possible. If we take the Magid Mishnah literally, what we do learn from the Magid Mishnah, even if demise would be remote, achas me'elef still would be defined as a chole sheyesh bo sakana. So once again, maybe the Magid Mishnah didn't do statistics and he didn't count numbers achas me'elef. But what we do learn from the Magid Mishnah, yes, the danger of losing a life is far-fetched. Baruch Hashem, it's remote. But it still would be defined as a pikuach nefesh situation. On the other hand, there's a tshuva and trumas adeshin going back also 600 years. And trumas adeshin in the psokim simesamech, and we find a similar tshuva in Leket Yosher. There was an incident of a fire breaking out in a town. And to prevent the spread of fire, the entire community was engaged and mobilized to build walls and moats to prevent the spread of fire. And that was Maleches Boine Diuraisa. And both the Tumas Adeshin and the Leket Yosha say that they need Shuva Vekapora, because the danger wasn't really substantial enough to be defined as Pikuach Nefesh to override an Issa Diuraisa, only an Issa Derabonah. So how do we reconcile the concept of a Yoledes on one hand, when the Magen Mishnah writes, it's natural, one out of 1,000 doesn't lose her life, but it still is defined as Pikuach Nefesh. Why would that be different than the story told in Trumas Adesh? Maybe the numbers are different. How could we know? But maybe there's a difference between a known situation which we are familiar with. And yes, death might be unlikely, but yes, people know there is a danger. And sometimes people lose their lives, and that would be considered a pikuach nefesh situation. However, when we're dealing with coincidence, it happened to be. So was there a necessity to build those walls and moats and violate the Nisa D'Oraisa to prevent the spread of fire? Probably the Poisik that was in charge, he was on the premises, he was on the spot, he bears ultimate responsibility for the psak. But the impression of those Gedolim was, no, there was no need to build those walls to save lives. And therefore, they paskin that tshuva and kapora are necessary. What I do think we could learn from the Magen Mishnah, if it is known and recorded phenomena, and we know that sometimes childbirth might pose a danger to the mother, to the woman giving birth, that would be defined as a pikuach nefesh situation to permit and necessitate Chilul Shabbos. And this brings us to many questions we have to deal with in our present time, more in Israel than anywhere else, to my dismay. How do we deal with trauma victims? So Israel has many friends, as you know, many more enemies than friends. And in the past 20 or 30 years, we've known many terror attacks, some of them horrendous. And one of the questions we need to deal with, is it permissible to be Machal Shabbos, to take care of trauma victims? PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorders. Trauma victims, psychological trauma, not physical injury. So would we be Mechalel Shabbos to have professionals rush to the scene of a terror attack, or just an extremely traumatic experience? It might be murder within the family. And to my terrible dismay, such things happen. Just a few weeks ago in Yerushalayim, a mother stabbed two children to death, and then took her life. So Hatzalah has the question presented to us. So people that aren't trained to deal with physical injury, but rather taking care of post-traumatic stress. So there is research, and many professionals feel that is extremely important to engage these people as soon as possible to the traumatic event. So as we know, post-traumatic stress disorder sometimes is a life-threatening situation. Some of these people might hurt themselves, might hurt others, might develop suicidal tendencies, and many professionals feel, even though we cannot say that we have conclusive research, but many professionals feel that it is essential to engage these people as soon as possible to the event. So I feel, with the limited information we have, yes, we would relate to these situations as pikuach nefesh, and we would permit Chil Shabbos to have these people come to the scene as soon as possible. However, based on the precedent of the Magid Mishnah and the Din of Yoledes, that shinui would be necessitated if possible, the same would be with trauma specialists rushing to the field. We should try to have a non-Jewish driver and minimize the Chilul Shabbos as much as we can. So coming back to the basic definition of pikuach nefesh, yes, I do feel that Reb Shimon Zalman probably was right, because we can't put it into numbers, and we cannot say how many percent do we need to define a pikuach nefesh situation. And in most situations, even today, we cannot say what is the chashash, how great is the danger, and we can't put everything into numbers or percentage points. So anything that will be perceived by people as a pikuach nefesh situation, as a life-threatening situation, probably that perception would have halachic validity as well. So we have dealt with some questions that come up defining mental health issues from the halachic standpoint. Would those situations be defined as pikuach nefesh? And we also broaden the scope of this discussion and this session, trying to define the limits and the boundaries. How do we define pikuach nefesh, dealing with Chilul Shabbos, especially with the Malach HaDiurais? As long as we're dealing with Amira Lenachri, we are on far more secure grounds, because Amira Lenachri is mutar, even for a Chayla She'ein Bo Sekon.
Hey, we're going to open it up now to questions in the areas of psychology. Where are those index cards? Somebody has the index cards. Dr. Pelkowitz is going to moderate this part of the session. We're going to hand out index cards for those who want to pass up questions about some of the particulars of what we've been discussing. And then I'll start with the first question.
The Rav mentioned that a person who is responding to an immediate crisis, a trauma incident, that the first responders, including the mental health professional, should be able to respond. The Rav also mentioned the case of the woman who her son killed her own children. So is the same halacha apply in the immediate aftermath of a terrorism that ongoing treatment of somebody who suffers from PTSD, or is it only in the immediate crisis after the event that precipitates the PTSD?
The question comes up primarily with immediate response, with first responders. Usually when a person is already in any treatment, it would probably be less common that we need to deal with the question of pikuach nefesh. However, if a professional gets a call and he gets a stress call from a person he is treating and he feels that the person's life might be in jeopardy, goes without saying. He uses his best judgment. And if he feels that the person's life might be in danger, that would be defined as a pikuach nefesh situation. The more pressing issue was the broader one, the more general one. Is immediate response for stress, would that be defined as pikuach nefesh, like immediate response for physical injury? Yes.
I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a psychologist.
Neither am I.
It's not uncommon for patients to talk about a relative, a husband or wife, what's in horror about them, just to vent. I'm not going to act on it, I'm not going to do anything about it, they're just going to vent. How do you say what's in horror to them?
Well, that is a very interesting and very relevant question. And sometimes in the course of treatment, people are encouraged to speak about their experiences, about their misgivings, about their relationships. So how do we deal with Hilchos Loshon Hara? I think anything that would really be part of treatment, and when the focus is not gossip, and it's not Loshon Hara, but treating people, I think that would not be defined as Loshon Hara. And that would be legitimate. I don't know whether it would be recommended, but if it is considered legitimate part of practicing and healing and treating people, I think that would not be defined as Loshon Hara. But maybe Dr. Pelkowitz could make us wiser on this question.
I don't know if I could make anybody wiser, but clearly what's often seen in the process of therapy is that you know when it's Lashon Hara and you know when it's L'Toelus. Very often when people who have suffered with family members or other people have the opportunity to disclose and talk and name the monster and feel heard and feel understood, it could lead to all kinds of benefits. It could lead to health benefits. It could lead to an improvement in the relationship, and it's qualitatively different than sitting down and just schmoozing in a way that you're bad mouthing somebody. It feels different, and it clearly has the therapeutic component to it.
So without being a psychologist or a psychiatrist, I felt the same. And if it is accepted practice in the field and the professional field that there is a benefit to it, then that would not be defined as Lashon Hara.
Given that we live in an age where there's constant discussion about disability policies, I couldn't help thinking about what the halakhic definition of disability might be in order for someone to be halakhically correct in applying for disability, or how we define it in the halakhic community.
If we are dealing with disability benefits, I think that the legal definition probably would be the halakhic one as well. I am not familiar with the guidelines. But if we are dealing with benefits, financial benefits, I mean, the ones that give any financial support to any cause are the ones that have the right to define who is entitled to get those benefits. So I would just guess that the legal definition of disability probably would be the halachic one as well. Just a rough just a rough idea of how do we define disability. The question is disability regarding what? So if we are dealing with financial benefits, I would just guess that the legal definition probably would be the halachic one. Yes, Rabbi Gnat.
A very common shaila that comes up, medically, halachically, we'd love to hear what the Rav has to say. You have a patient who's on psychotic medications, feels better, refuses to take them. He's currently a bar das, will become a lav bar das if he doesn't take them, in a danger. What does a halacha, what does Israeli society say you're allowed to do to force the patient to take his medications?
Today we have patient autonomy, and there are very limited situations in which you could force a patient to take treatment. I think most medical institutions in Israel have a special committee, and it is within the authority of that committee to decide whether a patient is of sound mind to decide to take or to refuse treatment. And if that committee determines and feels that he is not of sound mind, then in those occasions, the professionals have the right and the duty to force medication. But generally speaking, modern law gives a lot of autonomy to patients to decide what they wish and what they don't wish to receive. Halacha is far more stringent than modern philosophy in this area. And according to halacha, a patient does not have the right to refuse treatment if we are dealing with a life-saving situation. However, the ruling of most of the Gedolim of our time, primarily Reb Moshe and Reb Shlomo Zalman, is that when we're dealing with end-of-life issues and we could prolong the life of a person, but he will endure pain and suffering, the patient has the right to refuse treatment and say, I don't want this treatment that will prolong my life of suffering, and it is within the realm of his rights in many situations. When we're dealing with a terminally ill patient that is in extreme pain. But generally speaking, halacha is far more stringent and far less sympathetic to patient autonomy than modern law and philosophy is.
So I have a number of questions. First, some mental health questions that came in. So the first is, in terms of mental health medication on Yom Kippur, how do you take it? How much water? How much food? What are the general guidelines on how to do that?
Yes, so dealing with medication per se, taking medication would be a very, very minor transgression. Medication, by halachic criteria, is not defined as food, as achila or shtia. And it is shelo kederach achila, and for many reasons, we would be very lenient if the question would only be taking medication. The problem is, if a person can't swallow a pill without having water, and chotzeshir osim anatera, so drinking even a drop of water would be an issa d'oraisa. Dealing with an issa d'oraisa, once again, we need to decide that this is a pikuach nefesh situation. So coming back to the broader definition of mental cases, if we are dealing with a potential sakana, then drinking water would be no problem. But our recommendation is, if all the person needs is a drop of water to swallow a pill, then we would recommend that he passels that water, which means it should be shelo kederach Hanoah. If you use 3 tea bags for an ounce of water, that would be defined as shelo kederach achila, shelo kederach hashtia. If it doesn't agree with most people's taste, they would not find appealing, but rather repulsive, that would be defined as shelo kederach achila. And therefore, if all the person needs is some fluids to swallow a pill, that would be our recommendation.
The next question is about abortions in the case of rape and the psychological stress for the woman. So I guess it's two parts to the question.
Yes. The broader questions of abortions is something I would prefer to discuss in a more personal way. All I could say is that I am considered, in a way, and I'm not very happy about it, that I've become famous or infamous. I don't know how to define it, but many times I am more lenient than many other Rabbonim regarding various different situations in which the termination of a pregnancy is something that doctors would recommend. But I would not like to go into details of such a serious issue in such a broad forum. I think we should leave those questions more personal between the people relevant and the poiskim.
Okay, and just two more on the psyche. On the
I'll just present this one because there's a woman here who presented, based on our Moshe's answer about postpartum depression, what are the Rav's thoughts about placental encapsulation and placental ingestion?
You expose my total ignorance. Rabbi Schechter, you're not supposed to do that to me. Speak to me in Yiddish.
So if it makes anyone feel better, Dr. Pelkowitz also said he had no idea what this was.
Oh, then I'm in good company.
So we've been informed that what it means is, maybe you can explain it.
It's anecdotal and it's more holistic at this point. Sure. Hello. It's only holistic and it's anecdotal, so it's not scientifically proven and it's not accepted medically yet. So
it has been described.
It's been described, but it hasn't been studied or proven or well researched.
What is it?
It's post-birth, placenta is stored and then dehydrated or flash frozen and then ingested over a period of like 40 days in the postpartum period. It's either encapsulated in small capsules or it's actually ingested in its form, piece by piece, slowly over time. And it's anecdotally thought to help with postpartum depression, restoring iron levels, and helping with postpartum health.
Okay, so that would bring us. So we both learned something.
Thank you. Yeah, just as I understood it, it's a holistic medicine approach that's more anecdotal, but it involves taking the placenta, and these are what I imagine with women who are at risk for postpartum depression, and putting it into a pill form, and then they take it over a period of time as a way of preventing the onset of depression. Is that more or less what you said? Yeah.
Okay, so this brings us to a big discussion regarding the opinion of the Rambam, understanding a Mishnah Masechet Yumah. Chatzer HaKaved Mishenashchoy Kelev Shoyta. If a dog has rabies and a person was inflicted or bit by a dog that has rabies, so it was accepted practice in the days of the Mishnah to take the liver of that dog and feed it to the person that was hurt or infected. So Ramasya ben Cheresh, one of the Tanuim, says that is permissible, but according to the Chachamim, it is prohibited. And the Rambam writes, because wasn't proven to have any medical benefit. Many understand from the Rambam that only conventional medicine is valid, and only conventional medicine would permit macholas asurois or any other iser, not alternative medicine or holistic medicine. However, I wrote about this topic at great length, and my conclusion, my halachic opinion, was we cannot totally disregard alternative medicine. It all depends whether we have enough reliable research and information to determine whether something would be beneficial or not. So roughly speaking, I'm not a scientist, I'm not even a doctor. But the problem with many of these holistic methods is research, and is there any real scientific and recorded data which is sufficient to determine medical benefit or not? So maybe a day will come in which we will have more reliable data and information to know whether this is just anecdotal. Anecdotal would not be enough, or is it really reliable, and could we say that we know that this is beneficial to help postpartum depression or any other ailment? So I wrote in Minchas Sosher and Parshas Bechukoi site that a person should not take alternative medicine instead of known and proven and conventional medicine. People in many different ailments, if they want to supplement their treatment with holistic approaches or alternative medicine, are entitled to do so. Sometimes we would even recommend it, but I would never recommend taking holistic approaches instead of a conventional medicine that is known to be helpful.
I have a particularly hard one now. As the chairman of a pastoral services department in a psychiatric hospital, am I permitted to arrange for a cremation for a non-Jewish psychiatric patient?
Yes, to my dismay, these questions come not only from non-Jewish sources, but many times from Jewish families as well. And I would say dozens of times I was approached by people who some members of their family aren't from, and some of the people requested in their wills to be cremated. There's an amazing tshuva in Machne Chaim, and the Machne Chaim was a Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, and he speaks about a person that had to travel in non-sympathetic circles, and he couldn't openly be a Jew because his life would be in danger. And he asked, the Machne Chaim was one of the great poskim of his generation, if something happens to him out there and his body wouldn't be identified and he might be buried in an un-Jewish cemetery, and the Machne Chaim says it would be preferable to be cremated than buried amongst non-Jews. And that's an amazing tshuva. I do not agree with that psak. Now, this is what I just said is in no way amusing. That is part of the halachic process. I mean, we need to decide and deal with Rishonim and Achronim. Yes, I do not agree with that psak. I think it's extreme. I think that being buried amongst non-Jews is not final. And we could always hope that at some stage the body will be reburied. But if a person is cremated, then in no way could you bury him amongst his brethren at any other time. So what would be the prohibition of cremating a body? It would be the bitul of mitzvahs kvura, and kvura is a mitzvah. It would be a violation of kvoid hameis, because we are to care for the deceased and not burn their bodies. And therefore, I think it would be harsher than burying a person in a non-Jewish cemetery. So, but if a person does his job, and that is part of his job description, yes, he could administer and he could do any administrative duties to enable cremation if that is his job, especially when we're dealing with non-Jewish people, because non-Jews don't have the mitzvah of kvuras ameis, and therefore cremation might be permissible when we're dealing with non-Jews. So if that is his job, he could go ahead and do his job and perform his duty. So as I said, I had the unhappy experience of dealing with these shilas many times when dealing with Jewish people, to our dismay, and cremation definitely is a violation of various different halachic principles. So I remember I was asked by a Rav somewhere out there in the Midwest, and that was the first Gulf War, and a Jewish boy was killed in Iraq, and he was brought home, and the family planned to bury him in a military cemetery, and the Orthodox rabbi was approached and asked to officiate at the Levaya, and he asked me, should he go, because it's a non-Jewish burial? And I said, well, it all depends on the circumstances, and I definitely recommend that you should go. Because if you don't go, then probably they'll invite maybe the Reform rabbi of the community. You being there will give you the opportunity to get to know the family and be mekad of them, and maybe explain to them, not right now. Obviously, they were patriotic, and it was an honor for them to have their son buried with his fellow soldiers and with those that he served together with them. But maybe at some later stage, you'll get to know the family, you'll get to be mekad of them, and you will explain to them how important it is to have KV Yisrael. So what would be the benefit of not going? I mean, it's important that you get to know the family and engage them and mekad of them. So I just mentioned this because how important it is. When we're dealing with Hashkofa, we're not dealing with Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai, and we also always need to have our finger on the pulse of the times, Lefi HaMokim U'Lefi HaZman, to know what is the right thing to do right here and now.
Okay. By the way, there are a number of other questions that came in that are not on psychological issues that I imagine will be dealt with a little bit later, right? This is a child and adolescent psychology question. Is there a point where a child or a teen becomes the chol sheyesh bo sakana as a general matter? For example, allowing a parent to actually help the child be over on a doraisa with the aim of repairing the connection between the parent and child, thereby healing the child. For example, bringing the child to a Burger King, a Treif Burger King. Okay.
I think every community should have a kosher Burger King. And that would hard for me to see a situation in which I would say you could take a child and give him non-kosher burgers to fix his relationship with his parents. I think his relationship with his parents will be far enhanced if his parents will take him to a kosher restaurant and not to a non-kosher one. So it's hard for me to see a situation in which I would give a heter to be over on an Issa de Rabbanon, just in the context of giving a child a good feeling. We should be able to give him a good feeling in a kosher context.
A follow-up to Rabbi Dr. Glatt's question. Are there guidelines for schools requiring parents to administer medication, psychiatric medication, to children?
I think only professionals should administer any medicine to children, and I am extremely distressed that I know in some yeshivas, mashgichim are involved in recommending Ritalin or any other medication for children. I think only doctors, only professionals should ever recommend or administer medicine, and no one else.
Okay, real pain and imagined pain hurt the same. If the professional feels that the patient's pain is imagined, is Chilul Shabbos permitted for that patient?
Chilul Shabbos regarding a Malacha D'Oraisa is permitted only when one's life is in danger. Chilul Shabbos regarding an Issa D'Rabbanan, primarily a Mira L'Nochri, is permissible in many other situations. Pain is pain, whether it's real or imaginary. There is no such thing as imaginary pain. So maybe pain is felt for many different reasons. Some of them are psychosomatic, but at the end of the day, pain is pain. And whatever would be permitted for pay number one would be permissible for pay number two. And there would be no difference whether pain is imaginary. Our imagination is part of who we are. It's part of what we feel. So I think pain is pain, and we will deal with pain in the same way, regardless of what the origin of that pain may be.
It's interesting that even emotional pain in some of the neuroscience-based studies, the part of the brain that lights up when somebody is in emotional pain because of social exclusion is the same part of the brain that lights up when they're physically assaulted. And so from that standpoint. And I think this is still psychological, maybe the last one that's psychological before we go to the others, is how would one determine feeling better to be allowed to break a neder? And that's based on the Rosh Hashanah. What would the definition be?
Once again, the Rashba deals with violating a neder or a shavua, and Rashba defines it as a issa d'oraisa, which would be permissible only in a pikuach nefesh context. However, there are ways to deal with nedarim, and that is hatoras nedarim. So being matan neder doesn't really necessitate any pikuach nefesh situation. So I think, first of all, we need to deal with nedarim on an educational level and teach people to stay away from nedarim and shavuos. This is something that has to be out of, we don't do that. And I think we need to educate our children to totally stay away from neder and shavua. But if a person has a neder, the way to deal with it is with hatoras nedarim and not looking for a heter to violate the neder, but rather being mati neder. Violating a neder is an issa d'oraisa. So once again, we would need an extreme situation to permit violating a neder. So the way to deal with nedarim is just alide hatoras nedarim.
Okay, we're going to break now for some brunch outside. We're going to pick up at 11:45. During the break, if anyone wants to write questions on other medical issues outside of psychiatric illnesses, please feel free to do so.
Yes.
I didn't want to ask you on the court because I was a school principal.